This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill, coming to you from WTAN 1340, Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio station in beautiful Clearwater, Florida. Several weeks ago, I interviewed the agent, Andrea Brown. She is one of the premier agents for children's books and for everything from picture books to young adult fiction. She is actually probably the best agent out there for this genre. She is located in California, which tells you a lot because most agents would feel too insecure to move their offices to so far away from New York. But she has the ear of every major publisher. And when she calls and says she has found a new writer, they listen. It's very exciting that every year she holds a conference, a writer's workshop in Big Sur, and the applications are now available online, and it's at Big Sur Writing Workshop. The price is unbelievably reasonable. For less than $800, you can stay at the Big Sur Lodge, which is a beautiful, beautiful lodge located in the state park just south of Big Sur, and you would be working with her and her agents on a very personal basis. They really work almost one-on-one. The workshop, unlike most writers' workshops where you have like 200 people in a room, here you'll have three or four writers and an agent working with you. They work very hard to understand where you're coming from. So if you have your books finished, if you have a children's book or a young adult fiction book finished, then bring the book along and they will review it, they will talk to you, and they will lead you through it. Even if you just have an idea and a sort of an outline, they are incredibly talented at bringing out the writer in you. And if you are doing a picture book, for example, if you have a picture book, they will later on bring to the publisher the book, and the publisher will locate the right illustrator for you, because they also, Andrea Brown Literary Agency also represents many, many famous illustrators. So this is something you should think about if you're interested in really moving your project ahead. Go to the Big Sur Writers Workshop website and sign in. It's starts on December 4th. It's December 4th through December 6th. And as I said, you would stay at the lodge. The price is, it is probably one of the most reasonable prices for a workshop where you will really get to work with some of the very best people in the business. Because one, she attracts the very best people. And of course, all of the agents love coming out to Big Sur. So I really suggest if you're interested in progressing and moving on to the next stage, because many, many times she will just sign up new writers right at the end of the workshop. So go to the website and take part in Andrea Brown's annual workshop, and I think you'll find that it'll be a great benefit to you. Now, for all of you other writers who are out there and want to move ahead, remember that Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading is coming up. And if you're a writer, there are still opportunities to get a table there. And of course, if you're a reader, it is a fantastic opportunity. There will be many, many writers there at the event, and you'll be able to meet them, get their books and autographed books, and of course selfies, and get to talk and participate in some of the events to learn more about the art of writing and the work that goes behind writing. So it's a fascinating opportunity, and I hope that you'll take part. It's going to be October 24th, and it's sponsored by, this is a 23rd annual Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading at USF in St. Petersburg. So do mark your calendars for that. Now, you know, everything is, well, if you wait long enough, everything comes around again. And it's so funny how, you know, we, well, many people thought, of course, if you were reading a lot, you probably weren't so confident that the Cold War was over a few years ago. Of course, it is heating up again. It's been heating up for the past few years. And one of the most fascinating books that I've read in recently is a book called The Billion Dollar Spy, A True Story of the Cold War Espionage and Betrayal. And it was written by an author who certainly knows his stuff. And David E. Hoffman was the bureau chief in Moscow for 6 years. And prior to that, of course, he had been with the State Department in reporting from the State Department for the Washington Post. And prior to that, he had been covering President Reagan's White House and for a few years, President Bush's White House. So this is a man who knows Washington and knows Russia and or the Soviet Union. And so it's no wonder that this Pulitzer Prize winning author should write perhaps one of the most fascinating books to come out in years about the Cold War. And, you know, this is a true book. And, you know, you can have many works of fiction are exciting. But and sometimes it's not easy to write a nonfiction book that is as exciting as fiction. But this reads, it's a page turner, and you know, it's not just scrupulously researched, but he really makes a gripping story out of the entire operation of what was going on in the Soviet Union and in the betrayal and across the cultures and what about all the different spying going on in at that time. And so this is a real life spy story, and I think that you will really enjoy it. I'm so very, very happy that David Hoffman is able to join me today, and you will, if you get his book, I'm sure you will enjoy it. And it's called The Billion Dollar Spy, and it's one of the best stories to come out of the Cold War. And I think it has all the riveting and exciting adventure that you could want in any spy thriller. And knowing that it's a true story really will send a chill up your spine, because it's out there. The dangers are still out there. And his insight, David's insight into the events of the Cold War are fascinating. So with that, we're going to now turn to the phone, and David will join us. Hi, David, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Okay. I just played a little Russian music to set the tone for this very, very, very interesting book about the Cold War. You know, I'm going to say something to you that I've never said to a writer before. You know, your book actually made me sick.
Why?
Now, I tell you, I got this knot in my stomach when I started reading. After I had read, I don't know, about 15 pages, 20 pages. I get this knot in my stomach, and I'm thinking, my goodness, what is this? And I'm getting like, I'm really tense, you know. And you hear about page turners, you know, but I'm reading this, and sometimes I'm getting so upset at you know what was going on with the CIA and how they didn't have any spies in Moscow, you know, when you start the book. And I was getting like, all right, get a spy already, get this show on the road. So I had this knot in my stomach, but I love the book. I just, you know, once I started reading it, as I said, I was just getting angry. I think that we didn't have a better CIA compared to the KGB at the time.
Well, you know, the Cold War for a lot of people is fading into the mists of history, but for people that remember and live through it, it was a huge existential factor in our life, in our society. People had that knot in their stomach for four decades.
And I had it for the first 40 pages until things sort of I started calming down, because I was getting so upset myself.
But the book is really about a man that steps forward and risks everything in order maybe to build a little bit of a bridge over that gulf of understanding in the Cold War. He had two insights. He was a Russian man, an engineer. He was not a professional intelligence officer. He was not a professional spy. But he could see the system around him was a mess, was a disaster. And he was angry about that. And he had an inkling that there was another system, ours, that stood for something different. And so although the book is about an espionage operation, about spying, about the tradecraft, about money changing hands and secret meetings, at root, it's really about these two giant systems.
Well, Adolf Tolkachev, who is the spy that you're talking about in your book and that you write about so brilliantly, he came to our CIA as opposed to our CIA going out and getting anyone. What upset me when we would get spies and then they would get caught, and the CIA was, they would lose somebody. Sometimes it seemed simply from ineptness, and it was getting me very angry. So, but with Tolkachev, how many handlers did he have over the years?
Tolkachev, this engineer who had a lot of secrets because he worked in a top-secret military laboratory that designed radars, he volunteered to our CIA, and at first he wasn't taken seriously. I describe in the book his determined effort to try and make contact, which eventually he does. The operation begins in 1979 and ends in 1985. I tell the story of a few of the handlers, but I don't know them all. I would say he probably had six or seven over those years. Generally, the case officers for the CIA, the men that run a spy, spend 2 years in Moscow, maybe three, and in other capitals as well. They rotate them. And so Tolkachev, over the course of the 6 years, met a number of them every couple of years.
How did you get the details that you have in this book?
This book, The Billion Dollar Spy, is based on 944 pages of operational cables. In other words, the materials that the CIA station in Moscow, the office in Moscow, passed back to the headquarters in Langley, Virginia. And back and forth, they would send messages describing the operation, sort of thinking out loud about various options. And I asked the CIA to declassify those records, which they did, but it wasn't simply like sending a letter. It was a long period. It took a couple of years. They, in declassifying them, had to redact things they thought were sensitive. I had to work with the materials I got, which were sometimes incomplete. And then I had to interview the people involved. So it was like a giant jigsaw puzzle. And top to bottom, it took 6 years.
Well, it is so detailed that where you can precisely say where somebody was at 10:45, you know, in the evening in Moscow. And I just love all those details. Having I'm sort of following along, you know, the streets of Moscow. I always have I love maps, and I always have a map when I'm reading a book. So
we gave you one in the opening of the book there, so you could
yeah exactly, and that's what I was going to say. It was so nice to have that, because I love to sort of visualize where I'm going, and you really make it come alive.
But in my research, I walked those walks. I went to those places. I lived in Moscow for 6 years when I was correspondent for the Washington Post. And I know these neighborhoods and these buildings. So when I was researching the book, I went back. And I tried to walk the pathways that he walked when he was meeting with the CIA case officers.
Well, it comes through. You really make the scene come alive. It's very, very, it's very nice. I really enjoyed that.
You can imagine how it must have been for him, though. I mean, here he is risking his life, taking these secrets out of the desk drawers in his laboratory and giving them to the United States, a country that he had never visited. The man didn't have some kind of dreams of a vacation in Las Vegas or anything. You know, he had some larger principle at work, but it wasn't really about his personal comfort. They several times said, you know, can we take you out? Can we bring you to America? Can we get you out of this place that you're in that's sort of a hellhole? And, you know, he thought about it. Sometimes he was enchanted with the idea, but in the end, he never left. And one reason was that his family, for a period of time, didn't know what he was doing, and it would have been hard for him to leave without his family. But again, you have to ask yourself, what were his motivations? What motivates a man to risk his life to betray his country?
Well, of course, there's that old acronym MICE, which you might explain to people.
Well, it refers to some of the different motivations, such as money or compromise, somebody having something in their background that's, you know, causing them to hate the system. In Tolkachev's case, there was money exchanged, but, you know, in the time he was doing this in Moscow, there were shortages. There were bread lines. So there wasn't really a lot to spend the money on. And at one point, when he became really afraid that he might be discovered, he burned all the money the CIA had given him. But he never was able to go to a shopping mall. Tolkachev's motive lay deep in his own family's history. His wife grew up as an orphan in the years around World War II. Because her parents were both purged by Stalin. Her mother was executed, her father sent to the Gulag. And she married Tolkachev just a few years after her father had come out of the camps and told her what happened and then died. And I think that this great sadness that she felt by what had happened to her own family became his sadness too. And, you know, for a period there in the late 60s, I would say maybe the mid-60s, the early 60s, late 50s, there was a period called the Thaw, where many young people in the Soviet Union felt more optimistic. You know, the Thaw was Khrushchev's period and Sputnik, and there was some loosening up of controls over culture and expression. But the Thaw ended. The Thaw ended in Prague's spring being crushed in 1968. And I think Tolkachev and his wife had maybe felt for a while optimistic things would be better after World War II, but they weren't. And things got worse. The 70s became what they called the years of stagnation. Like I said, bread lines, a really grim existence. So Tolkachev's anger was about his past, about what had happened to his wife's parents, and about the present, about the state of the Soviet Union that he lived in at that time. And it was not pleasant.
Now, what years were you living in Moscow?
I was a Washington Post bureau chief in Moscow from 1995 to 2001.
So, by then, of course,
it was the wild Yeltsin years.
Uh-huh.
It was the first great experiment in democracy and freedom, and open markets in many, many decades. Some people think that this period was actually the most open and free in all of Russian history, in 1,000 years of history. There was one earlier period before the Bolshevik Revolution. It was shorter. And Russia's had this very titanic struggle to over this very brief window of freedom. It hasn't ended very well.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that came through in your book was the, I don't know how to say it. The CIA wasn't always impressive in what they did.
Well, I think it's quite clear the CIA was born after World War II. The Soviet intelligence agencies went back to the 30s, went back much earlier to the 20s. So they had a lot more experience, and the CIA was a little wet behind the ears, and they were also, I think justifiably, somewhat intimidated by working on the streets of a closed city like Moscow, where there were informants on every corner. It was, you know, the kind of thing where if you just struck up a conversation with a Soviet citizen, if you were a foreigner, you could get that person in trouble, and where family members informed on each other. So it was a very, very difficult time and place to run a spy. And so for a long time, that was one factor in why we did not have any terrific spies on the streets of Moscow. Another factor was our own paranoia and a fellow named James Angleton, who ran counterintelligence for the CIA at headquarters for 20 years, from 54 to 74, and his paranoia, thinking that anybody that volunteered or anybody that offered information must be a trap, that also took hold. And so that was also the CIA's fault and their own internal bias. This book is really about an operation that changed that, where they actually did run a successful operation on the streets of Moscow with Tolkachev. And Tolkachev met the CIA case officers 21 times on the streets of Moscow. Most of those meetings were within 3 miles of the front door of the headquarters of the KGB, and they were undetected.
Well, that's the amazing thing. Prior to that, generally they contacted, the spies contacted each other through mail drops and everything from hollowed out logs to pieces of hollowed out concrete. And then to have this where they actually met, was that part of what Tolkachev wanted, that he wanted to meet the people to see that they got the information?
He very much felt that these old methods of impersonally transferring information in a hollowed out log, which was used, or a hollowed out brick, he felt that if there was a risk in that, then you might as well meet face to face, because the risk would be the same. And, you know, he thought to himself, if I'm going to take all these risks to provide this information to the CIA, I want to look the guys I'm giving it to in the eye. I don't want to just leave it in a park under a tree. I want to see them and share my concerns and shake their hand. And that's why they took this much riskier approach of having personal meetings, which, as you said, had not been done very much in the years before.
So, in effect, the CIA was very lucky that they had this man come to them.
They were lucky, but they also were ready to be lucky. You know, they were leaving a period of timidity that had covered a good part of the 60s, when they didn't really have a spy in the Soviet capital worth the name. And in the early 70s, they had one or two that they had started to work on in the early 70s that hadn't lasted very long. But the key thing here was, in addition to the luck of Tolkachev volunteering, there were several station chiefs and case officers who were really ready and eager to work the streets aggressively to carry out the espionage operation in a way that would be successful. So you needed both those things.
And some of these people are people who have spoken to you about
their... They've given interviews for the book, and they describe it firsthand what it was like. And you have to remember that espionage operations are a little bit like a moonshot. You know, there's no room for error. You can't get one of the hoses disconnected. Your life and the life of your agent, the spy, depends on getting everything right. So the fellows who ran this, and they were mostly men, although there were a few women, they were perfectionists. They wanted to make sure that everything in a meeting on the street was just right, the body language, the whole handoff, the disguises, that there wouldn't be a mistake that would cost the spy his life, just like a disconnected hose on a spacewalk. You had to be a perfectionist to engage in this, and that meant enormous amounts of preparation, rehearsal, thinking ahead. And I oftentimes thought that spying was as simple as, you know, meeting the agent and asking him for the latest stuff. But actually, it was much, much more complicated. Logistically complicated, personally complicated, because this is really a business of psychology, of persuading somebody to steal information for you. And, you know, Tolkachev himself was a complex person. He had deep, deep disenchantment with the Soviet system, and he was very determined. But the CIA oftentimes disappointed him. And he, for example, asked them for a suicide pill, a cyanide capsule that he could swallow, and they dragged their feet and tried to say no, and eventually they give it to him. He wanted a certain kind of spy camera, and they gave it to him for a while, and it didn't work, and they gave him another one. It worked very well. And then they thought near the end of the operation that they wouldn't give it to him because they were afraid that he'd get in trouble with it. So there's a lot of tension here between the agent and the handlers. And this, if I've done anything, hopefully, that the reader will draw from this, it would be to make such an espionage operation real. This is not a slick, quick novel where everything is smoothed over. If you read this book, I think we'll get an appreciation for this complex nature of espionage, bureaucratic sometimes, nothing is perfect, things don't always work, people have, you know, disagreements about what kind of technology to use, the spy himself is moody, one day he wants $1 million, the next day says it's really not about money, he can't spend money anyway, so I hope I've achieved a level of realism about espionage that will be interesting.
Well, I think you have, and I want to talk more about it. I need to take a very quick little break, and I will be right back, okay? Hold on.
Is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing. Our assisted living lifestyle provides 24-hour assistance. You'll enjoy meals in your private dining room, housekeeping, linen and personal laundry service, scheduled transportation, personal security transmitter necklace, assistance with bathing and dressing, and supervision with medication. You'll really enjoy our in-house amenities, including a full-service waterfront dining room, outdoor garden patio, all utilities, including phone and cable, beauty and barber shop, and a library. An outstanding activities program awaits you, and so much more. You'll enjoy affordable luxury living, complete with a $1 million view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service makes the difference.
Coming up on Tuesday on the Rocket Sports and Entertainment Show, the new AP poll will be out. How far will Auburn fall? Will FSU move up? How many SEC teams will remain? We'll talk about that. Two Monday Night Football games, we'll recap those. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how embarrassing was it for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? We'll have Roy Cummings of the Tampa Tribune on to talk about that here on the Rocket Sports and Entertainment Network on the Tan Talk Radio Network, 2 to 4 p.m.
Are you looking for some great restaurants? For some great wines? Where are the great chefs? Just listen to Dine Out Radio Herd every Wednesday on the Tan Talk Radio Network. 12 to 1 p.m., we'll tell you where all the great events are. We'll have Food & Wine Magazine and Bon Appetit Magazine. We'll have their editors and writers on each month. And maybe we'll throw in a couple surprises. Check out the website, diningoutradio.com.
My bridge is all...
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, David E. Hoffman. Pulitzer Prize winning, I almost said Pulitzer Prize winning spy, because he just wrote a wonderful book called The Billion Dollar Spy. Are you there, David?
I'm here.
Okay, great.
I'll take it.
Well, I wanted to say, you know, I was telling the audience that you are a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and so that must have been a thrilling event for you.
Yeah, this was for my previous book, The Dead Hand, which was a story of how the Cold War ended and what its legacy was, with a lot of things like loose nukes and biological weapons.
Well, some people look fondly back at the Cold War. It seemed mild compared to what we're going through today. I don't know what this new war with Russia is called, because it's not cold. It's sort of sizzling all the time. And, of course, we have a major war in the Middle East all the time. But to go back to your book, which, The Billion Dollar Spy, let's talk about why it's called, why the book was given the name of Billion Dollar Spy. Why? What does that mean?
Cold War conflict, the real one, the big one, was not just propaganda. It wasn't just a trifle. This was a case in which two giant blocks competed with each other, not only with those big intercontinental ballistic missiles, but also in Europe, you know, there was a line drawn through the continent, and the two blocks were cheek to jowl, you know, guns pointed at each other, and a big part of that was aviation, you know, fighter planes and radar. So this particular spy, Adolf Tolkachev, a Russian engineer who volunteers to the CIA, begins to bring them information about Soviet radars. And radar is the eyes of an airplane, and in combat, radar is extremely important in dogfights and when planes are at war. And by looking at the information Tolkachev brought the Americans, it was possible to understand exactly how the Soviet radars work, to blind them, to intercept their communications. So if we were reading the mail, so to speak, of the other side, we'd have an enormous leg up. And at one point in the operation, the CIA, which is really an agency serving other agencies, said to the Air Force, well, we're getting you all this good stuff on radar. What's it worth? And the Air Force had an intelligence guy there who was reviewing it and sending it off to various places. He said, just what we've gotten so far, and this was not even at the end of the operation, it was after 2 or 3 years, he said, just what we've gotten so far, it saved us $2 billion in research and development that we didn't have to do or that we redirected because Tolkachev is reading the mail of the Soviet Union and delivering it to us. So I couldn't call the book The $2 Billion Spy. I thought that's Billion Dollar Spy would be...
It's a great title. It's a great...
Might get people's attention. But the point is that in a lot of espionage operations, the information might be who are the agents of the other side, counterintelligence, you know, bits and pieces, fragments. But this is a case of a fellow who, he didn't report on Politburo meetings. You know, Tolkachev didn't know much about the political leadership of the country or what Brezhnev was up to, but what he did bring were blueprints, schematics, secret documents, manuals, and at two different occasions he actually brought out circuit boards from Soviet radar. So this was a real windfall. This was a gold mine of intelligence, and I've tried in the book, although I didn't get any documents from the CIA about this, I've tried as a reporter to sketch out for the reader how this changed the equation. And one way it changed it is, you know, there are many things that go into training our pilots and designing our airplanes, but Vietnam was a real low point for the United States Air Force. We lost a lot of pilots and planes in Vietnam War because we had had very rigid and inflexible approaches to design and to training. And that changed after Vietnam, and it changed radically. And one reason it changed was because Tolkachev's information helped the United States design our airplanes so they could defeat Soviet MiGs. And in fact, in the 20 years after Tolkachev, no Soviet-built fighter ever shot down an American plane in a dogfight. We had complete air superiority, and Tolkachev contributed to that.
Well, he was worth his weight in gold.
But there was never a hot war between the United States and Soviet Union, but there were proxy wars. I mean, in the Iraq War, Saddam Hussein had a whole, you know, airfield full of these MiGs. And we were always on their tail because of Tolkachev. And had the Cold War ever turned hot, I think the United States Air Force would have routed the Soviet plane. Fortunately, it never did get to be a hot war. But I'm trying to show the reader why this was important.
Now, the CIA has given Tolkachev a great honor in that they have his photo at headquarters, correct? Not
it's
a photo,
portrait.
Painting.
No,
a portrait.
It's an oil painting.
An oil painting. Now,
it's a picture, oil painting that shows Tolkachev photographing secret documents in his apartment using a Pentax camera provided by the CIA, a simple 35-millimeter film camera that would have been a natural thing to see around the neck of any tourist at the time, and a clamp to clamp it on the back of a chair in his kitchen. And that's where he did his most productive work.
Let's talk about what happened to him. What was the ending of this, of what he had done for the United
States? Tolkachev worked for a couple years in complete without being detected on the streets of Moscow.
Like 6 years,
there was
right?
Never, yes, from 79 through early 85. And those meetings were all quite successful from an operational point of view. The KGB didn't see the meeting there. They didn't have a whiff of it. But at some point in 1984, which was already 5 years into the operation, Tolkachev was betrayed. But he was betrayed by an American, by a man who had been fired from the CIA, had been a trainee, and was fired, and knew a lot of secrets. And this man, when he was fired, decided that he was going to get back at the CIA, and he took the information to the KGB. And after a while, the KGB figured out what was going on, and they arrested Tolkachev in the spring of 1985. Tolkachev was interrogated, tried by a military tribunal, and I think that readers can find out what happened to him if they buy the book.
Exactly. They have to, because it's an exciting story. And I think that, you know, you have brought, as I mentioned, you have brought the period to life, and the tension sort of that was in the air. In the earlier part of the book where you're talking about Stanfield Turner and some of the events at the American Embassy in Moscow are very interesting. I particularly like the story about the fire at the embassy.
You know, in this period I described earlier, when the CIA was somewhat intimidated by the KGB on the streets of Moscow, that period was just beginning to end in the mid-70s. Angleton was forced to retire in 74. These young men who had practice some espionage techniques in Eastern Europe, were getting more antsy to get out there on the street to run aggressive espionage operations. But there was always some suspicion and fear at headquarters and elsewhere. And in August of 1977, there was a fire on the eighth floor of the American Embassy in the economics section. It was a pretty bad fire because they had done a renovation with flammable material, so it really took off and burned that whole floor. Well, the CIA station was one floor down on the seventh floor, and although it wasn't burned to a crisp or anything, there was a lot of water and hoses and stuff, and up the stairs came running these firemen. But, of course, they weren't firemen. They were KGB guys hoping to break into the station. And the station chief at the time was a very aggressive fellow named Gus Hathaway. Gus has passed away, but I interviewed him before he died. And, you know, he had a raincoat on because there was all kinds of water coming down from the eighth floor, but he stood there and barred the door and refused to let those KGB guys in, for which he later received a medal at the CIA. So the secrets were safe, but a lot of people wondered, how did that fire start? Did they start that fire as a provocation to try and get into the station? And there were other anomalies, and this eventually led the director of the CIA, Stansfield Turner, a former Navy admiral who Jimmy Carter had appointed. And this is, remember, Carter's first year in office. Stansfield Turner decided, let's stop everything in Moscow. Let's have a complete stand down, stop all operations. I'm too worried about what's going on there. And, you know, I think Turner was a pretty bright guy and had certainly in his education and his Navy service had excelled at systems analysis, at thinking through problems. But this was an unprecedented moment in the Cold War to actually close down your Moscow station. The people were still there. They weren't sent home or anything. But they were told not to do any spying on the streets of Moscow. And there were costs to that. Agents were lost. A whole period there when essentially we closed down the most important intelligence outpost in the Cold War. Now, this came back to life with Tolkachev. It came back to life with this operation. But it was a period of great uncertainty.
Well, and at that time also when Stansfield Turner stopped the work in Moscow, it was at the time that everything was boiling over in Iran, which it would have been helpful to know what the Russians were doing in that little scenario.
You know, I think that we didn't have any agents that knew what the Soviet leadership was thinking. And again, I think that part of the reason the stand down hurt us was we did have a few agents, but they weren't at any high level, and this really was going back to ground zero. Even when Tolkachev came along, one day the CIA gave him a list of 45 questions. We had a lot of different avenues of curiosity about what was going on in that leadership. And Tolkachev said, look, I can only answer 11 of these questions you've given me. I don't know some of these things. So the truth is that in the entire Cold War, there were very few moments when either the Soviets or the Americans knew what was going on in the minds of the other's leadership. The Soviets never had a spy in the White House either. We didn't have a spy in the Politburo. And that mistrust and the danger of that mistrust was the central characteristic of the whole period. I mean, if you recall the Cuban Missile Crisis and these incredibly dangerous calculations, I tell in The Dead Hand, in my previous book, about a period like this in 1983 called the War Scare, when, again, both sides kind of, you know, misjudged each other because we didn't have spies. And this is why this book is relevant to today. Even though we're talking about espionage carried out in the Cold War, it proves once again that if we live in a world that's got dangers, there are people out to get us who want to bomb Americans or attack us in terrorism or by military means. We need to know our adversaries. We need to know what they're thinking. And that's what intelligence is about, and it's why it's a critical part of our national security. Having all the weapons and nuclear-powered submarines in the world won't help us if we don't know what they're thinking. Human intelligence, like Tolkachev, is rare. It's difficult. It's hard. But I think the Tolkachev case shows that it's absolutely essential. You can't get everything you need through signals intelligence and satellite and overhead satellites. You do, once in a while, need to talk to somebody who really knows.
You're right. You know, that's one of the reasons I really, you know, the minute I read your book, I wanted to talk to you, because it was exactly this, the how compelling it is for people to, I'd give it to every college student, because so often they come out or they're in college and they're naive about what's going on in the world. They don't understand what's happening in the world, and they can't sort of conceive of all of these conflicts and all the different ideas. And your book really shows how the sort of the thinking at the time, where some people were not thinking properly, as far as I was, like Stanfield Turner, I think that was a terrible thing to do, to stop operations, because there are enemies out there, and you have to know what's happening, and the other side doesn't stop, you know. Sometimes I think Americans can be a little naive about it, that, you know, we want things a certain way, and it's hard sometimes for us to understand that the other guy is out there ready to, you know, to keep spying on us, and we have to be prepared.
But I think there's another big misconception, which is people think the CIA is all about covert action and paramilitary, and certainly a lot of it is. Over the decades, the CIA has gotten involved, whether Bay of Pigs or Vietnam, even the torture after 9/11. These are all covert actions and sort of paramilitary actions. But one thing that people don't know is that one of the things that CIA does that they sometimes have done very successfully, not always, but sometimes, is human source intelligence. Just persuading somebody on the other side to tell us what's really going on. And, you know, we put a lot of stock in the signals intelligence, like when we tap into their cell phone conversations or read their email, or satellite overhead intelligence when we see a photograph that shows a tank parked on a certain forest. But in the end, you really need to know what's in the minds of people. And you can't always tell that, despite the wonders of all these technologies. You can't always tell it unless you can actually go out and run spies. It's hard work, but don't you think we need a human source inside ISIS? And, by the way, inside the leadership of the Chinese and Russian governments? Don't you think we want to know what this leader of North Korea is thinking? All of these things would be good targets for human spies.
Exactly, and that's why I think it's important that people read your book. And over the years, of course, you've been a major correspondent for the Washington Post, and you've covered so many exciting stories. We're now in a new political period for the 2016 race, and of course, you covered. Ronald Reagan's campaign, didn't you?
30 years ago.
Wow. More
than 30 years ago, right? 1980.
1980.
I covered Reagan's 1980 campaign and the Reagan presidency for the Post.
So did you get to travel with him?
Everywhere.
Yes.
For years, constantly, including the big summits with the Soviet Union and the weekends in Santa Barbara. I covered almost all the Reagan presidency. Not quite. There were some in the first year where I wasn't covering it. But I covered the 1980 campaign for the Knight Ridder newspapers, which no longer exist, and came to the Post in 1982 and covered Reagan until 1988. And then I went off and covered Bush when he was running for president in 1988. I'll leave you with a thought about that, which is that I think the Reagan presidency was definitely one of the most important of my lifetime. But he was not an easy guy to understand, and people are still writing books and trying to figure out what made him tick and what happened.
Did he take an interest in the CIA? Was he deeply involved?
I don't think that he was He didn't take a deep, detailed involvement in very many things, but he delegated. And in this case, he said to Bill Casey, who was the CIA director, you know, I want you to be an activist. I want you to run spies. And Casey was sort of the opposite of Stansfield Turner, you know, and he said, look, I don't want fewer spies, I want more. And Turner and Carter were entranced by the technology of the day, which was a new generation of satellites had just gone up, and they loved those overhead satellite images. But Casey, who himself had served in the OSS during World War II, he wanted guys like Tolkachev. He wanted, so he put a new emphasis on it with Reagan's approval to run more spies.
Well, that's a sign of a great leader when you can delegate. Right?
I think also Reagan just wasn't a detail man. And we begin to see, you know, you can read Reagan's diaries now, the published diaries in two volumes. It's a fascinating thing to read. But you see that the details didn't interest him, just the big picture. And maybe that was part of his genius as a leader. But it was also just very much part of his character, you know. He was not inclined to get on his hands and knees and look at some map on the Oval Office floor like his predecessor did.
Or like President Johnson did. You know, I'm deeply involved with the F-105 pilots of the Vietnam War. I'm working on a project called Forgotten F-105 Warriors, and it's about the pilots. And then you mentioned there about the importance of what we learned from Tolkachev about the radar, because during the Vietnam War, the F-105 pilots were sent on the same mission at the same time on the same route every day, and the losses were so enormous. And
it was a disaster, and the whole thing was too rigid. The airplane designs were too rigid. The missions were too rigid. And one of the things that come out of that was the F-15. And the F-15 was essentially designed based on the lessons of Vietnam, and especially the F-15C, the F-15E. These airplanes were highly maneuverable. The pilots were given autonomy to make their own decisions, much more flexibility. So we learned those lessons, but they were hard lessons.
Very hard lessons. And so I'm very happy to recommend your book to everybody. And I hope that you have a great success with it. I don't know, have you already been, have you been an advisor on some of these spy shows that have recently been showing up on television?
No.
Not yet?
I'm an author. Yeah. I'm an independent author. I write the book and hope people read it. That's about as far as I go.
Well, I think that you have so much, well, the amount of information you've gathered is tremendous. And you've written a really compelling story. And I really appreciate having you on the air today. And are you doing a little book tour, or are you going around the country?
You know, I'm not doing a lot of that, but I'm doing a lot of radio, including with you, and that's a lot of fun.
Okay, well, that's great. It was great to have you on today, and best of luck with the book. And, you know, I have a feeling maybe somebody's going to grab you and say, let's make a movie out of this, because it is a really compelling story.
Betsy, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me today. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
WTAN Clearwater, Tampa Bay. WDCF Dade City, Tampa Bay. WZHR.